When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lay.
Ben Walhood from Chicago is joining us on the podcast today. Ben has built a portfolio of 28 rentals over the last couple of years. I want to hear his story and figure out how he did this. And specifically today, I want to talk to him about how he evaluates deals, what he's looking for in a rental. I want to get into some of the numbers he's looking at. First, I want to take a quick break and thank our sponsor today, and then we'll get right into the content.
Are you having a hard time finding great investment properties? Unfortunately, the best deals are rarely found locally. Successful investing begins with the right properties in the right markets. Norada Real Estate provides everything you need to invest in the best deals across the U.S. Our simple, proven system will help you create real wealth and passive monthly cash flow. Get your free copy of the ultimate guide to passive real estate investing at noradarealestate.com/guide. That's noradarealestate.com/guide.
Ben, what got you first interested in buying rental properties?
Probably like a lot of your listeners and a lot of real estate investors today, I got hooked reading Rich Dad Poor Dad. Somebody gave me that book back in 2002. I read that while I was in college and got quickly addicted to the idea of financial freedom, passive income, and just read everything I could get my hands on and started working to buy my first property back then in college. And fortunately, even though it took me a few years of banging my head against the wall, eventually the no doc loan came along, and all of a sudden anybody with a pulse could get a mortgage. So it was a little bit of right place, right time, but not without a few years of trying and failing. So I eventually bought a brand new 3-bed, 2-bath house while I was still a full-time student. And I rented out 2 of the rooms to my college buddies, and I lived there almost rent-free. And I still actually have that rental to this day. So after that experience, I was pretty well hooked on
real estate. That'll get you hooked. That's a really good deal. Now, I love the fact that it took you a long time before you made that leap. And you mentioned that you had some failures. What happened? Like, why? What held you back from getting started?
Sure. Well, when you walk into a bank and say, "Hey, I'm a full time student. I make about $8,000 a year at my part time job."
Yeah,
they should laugh in your face, right?
Right.
I was completely qualified for the loan, but that didn't stop me from trying. So
right.
I just kept reaching out to contact after contact, asking friends and family, finding, you know, other more creative lenders. You know, if you go to your local, big box bank, if you want to call it that, a Wells Fargo, US Bank, whoever, they all pretty much have to fit the square peg in the square hole. So
right.
If you get around enough, you'll eventually find somebody who's a little more flexible. And so I did that, and I still couldn't find anybody that could make my scenario work.
Right.
And so, you know, it was just a matter of kept pounding the pavement, kept asking questions. And eventually, after a couple hundred no's, finally somebody said, "Oh, yeah, we've got this new product where as long as you've got a credit score and a job, we'll give you a loan."
That's great. Yeah. So how do you go from there to where you are today? Like, you have 28 units today. How did you build your portfolio? Was it just one at a time, one deal at a time? Or did you at some point say, "I'm going to get more aggressive with this and buy properties more aggressively"?
It was definitely more of the hockey stick curve for me. So I bought that first property in, that would have been 2005. And then I took a full-time job and moved around the country multiple times for work. And every place I went, by the time I felt comfortable enough with the market to start making offers, this isn't a bad thing, but I'd get promoted and be moved out of state again and start all over. So I attempted to buy additional properties for a few years. And then finally, when we settled in the Chicago area, would have been 2010 that we finally settled in here and bought an additional property. We've been here now since 2009. So we started buying, you know, one a year, then two a year, then four a year. What, in 2015, I think we bought 12 units. So
wow, that's a big leap to go up to that many units in 1 year. What changed? Like, how did you have that incredible growth?
Well, it was a couple of things. So I was still working a full-time job up through 2013. So it was, you know, spending nights and weekends researching properties and working with my team. So that led to the fact that we could only do a few a year effectively the way we were doing it. So I became a full-time investor beginning of 2014. And at that point, you know, got a lot more focused, got a lot more driven. I mean, that was the only source of income for my household. So obviously, we were pushed to go out and pound the pavement every day, finding new deals and building the team and building a system. And, you know, it's gotten to where it runs pretty smoothly. You know, a good contractor, a good property manager, and a good realtor, you know, if they're all communicating well and doing their part, the thing can run like a well-tuned machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's dive into that. When they're working together. So say your realtor comes to you and says, hey, I found this great deal. Let's just say hypothetically, it's a foreclosure that comes on the market. Will you make an offer on that property without seeing it? Or do you always go out to the property to take a look at it?
You know, early on, I'm a bit of a control freak by nature. So early on, I always had to go out there and see it with my own two eyes before I risked my money. You know, that was kind of the mindset. At this point, we make offers all the time on properties we've never seen. If a property pops up on the MLS and it's in our target area, we do it every day. So we know our numbers pretty solidly. So, you know, if it's a smoking deal, we'll get our offer out there sometimes within an hour of it hitting the market. If it's kind of middle of the road, we know it's not going anywhere. We know it might be kind of a low ball offer. And we might take our time and my realtor might go out and walk through it and come up with some numbers for us. And so we still make an offer if it's a property we're interested in. But the good deals go fast. So we move, you know, we'll do our inspection and our walkthrough and our rehab budget in fine detail once we've got it under contract.
So have you ever gotten a property under contract and then you get in there and it looks different than the pictures or it needs a lot more work than you had imagined it and the numbers don't work anymore? And then you have...
Absolutely.
Okay. So you'll just get released from the contract, move on, find something else.
Exactly. Yeah. Some of those realtors out there are very creative and clever with their photos.
I've seen those pictures. Yeah. Yeah, it can be a whole different story when you get in there.
Right.
Yeah. So tell me, like, when you're looking at the pictures, or maybe even if your agent went in there, how do you figure out about how much it's going to cost to fix the property up? Do you have, like, just is it an idea that you have that because you've done so many that you know, all right, it's probably going to cost me $25,000 to fix this property up? Or do you bring your contractor in to get an estimate?
Sure. So what we do is I've put together a spreadsheet over the years that we just keep tweaking and making it better, that includes all the pricing that we typically see from our contractors, you know, a cost per square foot for tile and, you know, cost per bundle for shingles and things like that. So all that's in a spreadsheet so that he can walk through and just say, yes, it needs a roof. Yes, it needs 10 windows. No, it doesn't need paint in this one. And it spits out a number that's generally accurate.
So on that spreadsheet, you've got a window is maybe $300. And so if it's 10 windows, you know that you're going to need to budget $3,000. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Are there other things that you're looking for? I know a lot of investors want to buy in a good school district. Is that important to you or does it not really matter?
So that one's not particularly a focus area for us. And reason being that my mindset is that the market is telling us where they want to live. So if we look at a market and say, hey, houses are selling very quickly or selling for more than another neighborhood, or more really my focus would be what they're renting for. Mm-hmm. So it is telling me that there's a lot of rentals going through here and the prices are rising. That's how the market tells me if it's a desirable area. I don't really feel the need to know one school district versus another. Clearly, there's going to be a correlation, right? The area that's rents are rising quickly and home sales are rising quickly, those are probably in good school districts.
Right.
You know, but it's a little bit of the cart before the horse in my mind.
Yeah. You know, that's something that, like, personally I've struggled with, because we've had so many people on this show say that they want to buy a property in a good school district. But it's hard for me to wrap my head around that, because a lot of people live in bad school districts. And if you maybe live in a bad school district and you're looking to move as a tenant, you maybe don't want your kids to change schools. So you're going to want to stay in that school district. So even though maybe that school district isn't a good ranking school district, it's still desirable for some tenants. So
and keep in mind that not everybody has school age children either. Right.
Right. So that's true.
We try to focus a lot on who our target tenant would be. And in some areas, our target tenant is a single young professional. Well, they could care less what school district they're in, right? They're looking for other things. And again, the market comps are what tell me that they, you know, certain areas are where they want to live.
Right.
So that's part of it too. But I mean, that being said, we have been burned in the past where we were comping a neighborhood that was, we thought to be in the top school district. So it wasn't so much that the school district mattered for us, but we had to make sure we were comping apples versus apples. And we got burned because we made a mistake, and we were literally on the district line. Across the street was school district A, the desirable one. We were on the other side of it, the less desirable one. And it was simply, you know, trying to let the market tell us where they want to live. We did that, but we accidentally comped some of A with B, and so we got an inaccurate number.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, so you really got to know your market, and for people that are maybe buying out of town, you're really not going to know that without knowing the area really well. So yeah, that's a good cautionary thing for people to be aware of. Is there like a sweet spot for you in terms of the price range that you're looking to buy at and what the property will rent for? Is there kind of a target model that you follow?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our sweet spot is with an ARV of between 150 and 250,000. So we're out here in the western suburbs of Chicago, where that's generally kind of a blue collar working class neighborhood. And those properties will rent anywhere from 1200 to maybe 2000, 2200 a month. So it's roughly the 1% rule.
Okay.
The rent, approximately 1% of the value.
Now that's a good point that you brought up the 1% rule. And for anyone that doesn't understand what that means, that the 1% rule is that if you buy a property, you want it to rent for 1% of the purchase price. So a property that's $100,000, you want it to rent for $1,000 a month. Is the 1% rule kind of like a floor, like that you won't go below that? Or like, is it ever close enough if maybe you're just under 1%, maybe at 0.8, or do you really want to be at 1% or higher?
Sure. So our range is 0.8 to 1.2. And
okay.
And that's like kind of an arbitrary number, but that's from a lot of trial and error. And so if you think about this, when the number gets lower, that means the properties are probably more expensive. It's probably a nicer area. And, you know, you get $1 million property. Generally, those aren't renting for $10,000
sure.
a month. The rent kind of falls off a cliff as you get into higher priced homes. And then on the flip side of it, there are certainly parts of the Chicagoland area where you can buy a house that rent is 2-5% of the value because the homes are so cheap. And generally, when you start seeing those that ratio climb really high, typically those are less desirable neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. They might be on cash flow on paper, but they typically are more difficult assets to manage.
Right.
So I've been on both sides of the fence. It's a lot of trial and error where we had some that were high, some were that were low, and we found the best performance to be right around the 1%.
Okay. Now, when I've evaluated deals, I've always had a hard time with getting any kind of profit out of anything that's 0.8 or under 1.0. So are you like, are you finding the same thing in your market? Because I know that the taxes are different in different areas, and maybe the insurance cost, and that, so it's the 1% rule is almost like a good rule of thumb, but I wouldn't advise anyone to buy a property just because it meets the 1% rule. But do you, are you able to actually have much cash flow on those 0.8% properties?
Great point. Yeah. And the short answer is no. So typically if we're buying anything that's below 1%, it's because it's probably a nicer area, a nicer, more modern home. Typically, they're probably already a little bit higher priced, and we expect them to appreciate better average. So, and that's why it's a portfolio, right? Some of the properties cash flow well, but they probably won't appreciate as strongly. And then on the flip side, it's, you know, the exact opposite. And you mix that together and you've got a strong base of cash flow over the whole, you know, but as the years go on, you might sell off one or two here and there as they hit the appreciation goals you're shooting for.
Right. And, you know, one thing that that you're doing that I absolutely love is when a property turns over, you'll put it up for rent and for sale at the same time, right? Tell us about that.
So again, coming back to what the market is telling us, there's a price at which I will sell anything in the portfolio, right? And I think anybody could say that, right? If somebody comes along and offers you $1 million for your $100,000 house, you'd happily sell it.
Sure.
So, and vice versa, I'd love to rent it if a great tenant comes along and is willing to pay what I want in rent. So we always come up with a number that I'd be happy with for either the rent or the sell price. We'll put it on the market for both. And, you know, sometimes we need, let's say we need short-term cash. So we might drop the sale price a little bit and raise the rent price, kind of tipping the scale that telling the market, hey, this is what we want to see happen. And vice versa. If it's something we definitely want to hold, we jack up the sale price to a point where we'd still be happy if we got it, but we're not expecting it to sell. We're expecting to see a quality tenant come along and rent it and hold it longer.
If you're not expecting to sell it, but you can sell it and walk away with maybe a $40,000 profit, why not? And then you can take that money and buy something else that's going to cash flow better. So I think that's really good. I think that's really good. Now, what about budgeting for repairs? Do you set aside a certain amount of money every month to deal with repairs that come up, or when you have a property turnover, that's probably going to cost you some money? Do you set aside money, or do you just deal with that expense as it comes up?
Great point. And I think for people that are listening that are maybe buying their first property, or they've got a couple of them, I highly recommend that you're setting aside something for CapEx, you know, capital expenditures every month. And you've got your separate little pool that it's not in your personal bank account. It's maybe not even in the same business account, but you've got it in kind of an escrow somewhere that you know you're not going to touch it, and it's there if you need it. And we did that early on, where, you know, we were pretty lean those first couple of properties where, you know, we're getting $100 in cash flow from the whole portfolio or something. You know, it wasn't a lot of money. We had to make sure we had that cash on hand. So we did that early on. At this point, it's a large enough portfolio. There's enough cash flow coming in every month that even if it was a fairly significant rehab, you know, we've got that cash available. So I don't necessarily set it aside a committed amount from each property every month, but we do make sure that we've got that capital sitting there in case we need it.
So if someone is just getting started, maybe they're buying their first property, what would be a good amount to set aside every month?
It definitely depends, right? That's always the answer in real estate. Yeah. In this case, it depends on the age and condition of the property, right? So a lot of our properties, my primary strategy is to fix things up like new, you know, make them look like a flip, and then put them on the market. And we'll lease them that way and find high quality tenants. So my point is that in that case, we've gone through and updated every aspect of that home. We expect maintenance to be very low, and we expect to have almost no capital expenditures for, I'd say, at least 10 years. So in that case, it would be a small amount. If you had a home like that, you're either you rehabbed it yourself or you bought it turnkey or someone else had fixed it up. You know, if you're putting aside even $25 or $50 a month, it's probably going to be plenty. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a home built turn of the last century and you know the structure is 120 years old, it doesn't matter how much rehab you do, that will eventually need some pretty big expenses. Sure. So home like that, I'd probably be close to $50 to $100 a month, depending on which stuff, which items I knew were deteriorating.
Mm-hmm. So when you're doing your rehab on, say, a brand new property that you bought, will you replace, like, say, a hot water heater if it's 5 or 6 years old and, you're going to be able to get maybe another couple of years out of that? Will you go ahead and replace it now so that you don't have to worry about it or get a call one day that the hot water heater is leaking and you need to replace it and it's an emergency? Like, so how do you handle that?
Yeah, exactly what you just said. Typically, the rule of thumb for us is if the expected lifespan on the device or, a hot water heater or the roof or, whatever it is, if it's less than about 5 years, we'll go ahead and replace it.
Okay.
And that comes from sort of the optimistic view that every tenant we get is going to stay for 5 years or even more. So we want to make sure that just the exact example you brought up, that they don't move in and 6 months later, the water tank blows, leaks all over the floor, destroys our carpet, destroys their possessions.
Right.
It's for everybody to save, $800.
Right.
It's not even saving. You're just literally postponing that spending. So if anything's short on its lifespan, we'll go ahead and replace it before we put a tenant in place.
You're really getting tenants to stay for 5 years. Is that that kind of your average?
Honestly, I can't tell you an average because the bulk of our portfolio we bought in the last 5 years.
Right. Okay.
A lot of those do still have the original tenants in there.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, my guess would be 3 or 4 years will probably be our average if we jumped into the future and looked back. But that's also partly because of the product I work with. In single family homes, people are far less likely to stay for a year and leave.
Right.
And then we've got studio condos where if they sign a second lease, that's unusual. Pushing for that, we're hoping for that, but it's just a more transient person. It's a more transient product. But when the husband, wife, 2.5 kids and a dog move into a single family home, generally it is their home. They're going to stay there a period of time. So it's different with each type of property and each class of tenant.
Yeah, I mean, that's really good. I mean, that's a really good strategy to fix the houses up nice and try to keep long-term tenants, because that turnover is, I think, what kills so many landlords, because you're constantly having to fix the place up when you have a tenant move out and you're probably going to be vacant for a month or two. So if you can keep those tenants in there longer, that's, I think, really the way to be way more profitable. Well, Ben, if somebody wants to learn more about you, why don't you give us your website and tell us about your RIA club?
Sure. So my company website is goapexrenovations.com. You can reach me through there. I'm also on LinkedIn. And I'm also the president of the largest nonprofit RIA in Illinois. It's the Chicago Area RIA. So you can find us at Caria, CAREIA.org. And we'd love to see you at any of our future events.
Great. And how often do you guys meet?
Our general meeting is once a month, and then we've got a total of 3 events throughout the month. So you can find that either on our website or through Meetup.
Awesome. And I will go ahead and put links on our website. If you missed that, you can find it at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode96. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.
It's Can-Can, over 50 years of endless deals.
Now, Shopify does the Can-Can, selling lots of brands on everything in Can-Can. Today is great to save some cash, so come to Shopify's Can-Can Bash. Can-Can, you save much more on every brand. Can-Can.
Find endless deals at Shopify's Can-Can sale. Going on now. You can't miss it.